Today's reading is from Ephesians chapter 5, verses 1 to 14. Follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. But among you, there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality, or of any kind of impurity, or of greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. Nor should there be obscenity, foolish talk, or coarse joking, which are out of place, but rather thanksgiving. For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a person is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of such things, God's wrath has come on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be partners with them. For you were once darkness, but now are light in the Lord. Live as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists of all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And find out what pleases the Lord. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. It is shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret, but everything exposed by the light becomes visible, and everything that is illuminated becomes a light. This is why it is said, "Wake up, sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Morning. Paul continues in chapter 5, the instruction he started at the end of chapter 4. And this week, he's focusing on how Christians behave. And this week, he focuses on sexual immorality. Every week we have in the media more stories about partners being unfaithful and about other improper sexual behaviour. Paul talks in this passage about Christians avoiding all appearance of sexual immorality and being seen as pure and holy. In Paul's world, as in ours, the temptation to be involved in some aspects of this were all around, as they are all around for us now. Pornography is as old as human relationships, and they've found graphic descriptions of sexual activity on the walls of the Pompeii ruins when they've been uncovered. And that was submerged by volcanic lava from Vesuvius around the same time that Paul was writing this letter. He's writing to the Ephesian church. It was a very wealthy city, mainly because it was the home to one of the seven wonders of the world, the temple of Artemis or Diana. And she was the goddess of fertility, where all the priests were female, and sexual activity as part of worship of Diana was commonplace. So standing out as a Christian and not being involved in any of these activities was difficult, as it is now, with all our social media, internet sites, and everything else. But first, before Paul goes on to that, he reminds the Ephesians of the basis of their behaviour. Three times in the first two verses here, he uses the word love. Follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us and gave up himself for us. He urges them to walk in the ways of God's love and to imitate God in all they do. Our whole motivation as Christians is in response to God's love for us. We can't imitate God himself as we've never seen him, but we do have the example of many of his servants that reflect his nature in all they say and do. Paul may have it in mind, fellow believers at Ephesus, but he certainly would have had in mind those people, those servants of the Old Testament that we can look at as well. There's Abraham and Moses, Joshua and Caleb, Deborah and Ruth, David and Jonathan, Elijah, the widow of Zarephath, Isaiah and Ahaz, Homer and Hosea, Hosea and Gomer. Wouldn't have Homer as a role model. And especially in the New Testament, the example of Jesus and his relationship with Mary, his mother, Herod, Zacchaeus, Peter, Judas, Mary Magdalene, and Cleopas. He is the supreme example of how to relate to others with those not usually welcome in society, at ease in his presence. And particularly, we notice how many women were at ease in his presence. So much now we read of media reports about how women feel threatened, were assaulted, or irritated by males. But in Jesus, there were many women around who wanted to help him, wanted to be part of his disciples. And they helped him and were perfectly at ease in his presence. As Paul goes on, setting out the scene in verses 1 and 2, everything is surrounded by love. That's the motivation. He then goes in to describe negative and sinful states of sinful nature. As we glance through these, we may think, well, hang on, I can remember telling a coarse joke way back. Does that mean I'm out of the picture now? But Paul is talking about a settled state, people whose habitual nature is to do these things. We all fail, we can all receive God's forgiveness. Because if all of us were honest, none of us would be able to go any further because we'd all failed. But Paul is talking about a settled state of nature that hasn't been turned over to God. First thing he goes on to stress is that their actions should be pure. If we are loved by God and he is holy, our actions too should be holy. He talks about sexual immorality. Now it may surprise you to know this, but sex is God's idea. He created sexual drive. The Book of Song of Solomon is all about the human desire between a man and a woman. And God has created us with that sexual desire to be strong and constant throughout all of our lives. We should thank God that he didn't make us like pandas, who live all the time in bamboo shoots alone, only able to procreate 3 times a year. Oh, she looks nice. I'll have lunch first, though. We're not like that. We have to battle with our human desires throughout all our lives. And nothing in humanity has been tainted more than their sexual drive, our most basic instinct. Ever since Adam and Eve disobeyed God and were separated from him and from each other, the relationships between men and women have become more complicated. When a man and a woman get married, God doesn't rearrange all the hormones so that they're directed only between their partner. Their attraction remains totally focused. We remain fully sexual beings with free will. So as Christians, we need to constantly ensure that our relationships with the opposite sex are appropriate. We need to be open and honest with ourselves and each other so that we do not fall into temptation and sin. So many natural friendships start well, but stay into relationships that are inappropriately intimate. I'm sure we all know of families that have been broken apart by relationships that should never have been formed in the first place. They were careless, they weren't guarded, and there's been devastation caused to many people. In my own knowledge, I know a Baptist minister who left his wife to live with a widow he was counselling. I know a small town school where families of two teachers, one was the head and a colleague, became friendly. The head set up home with the female colleague and devastated their respective families. A Bible college lecturer and his wife were helping a distressed female student. The wife felt the relationship was getting out of hand and wanted to end it and pass over to someone else, but the lecturer felt it should continue and ended up by leaving his wife to set up a home with the student. A young couple moved into their first home and were delighted to have another young couple as neighbours, as Christians. But over time, they realised their relationship with each other became strained as there was a mutual attraction with the other neighbour. And to preserve both marriages, one couple moved away out of the area. We need to be open and honest about recognising temptation. You might say, well, my husband or wife loves me and I love him or her, and I could never be unfaithful. And I'm sure that's true. You don't intend that to happen. But we never know when temptation will arise. A new person at work or moving to our street can suddenly assume a new significance that we were not prepared for. The attraction is there. We should not be naive and guard our relationships and be honest about our motivations. It's very difficult. And for those of us who are single, for whom the sexual drive is not fulfilled yet because we're not married, it's hard to be faithful and true to God. But we need to be open about our relationship with each other. Is the extra Zoom conference or meeting after work we have with a new attractive colleague, is that really necessary? Would that happen if that colleague was a person of the same sex? It's always easy to scoff and to say that any perceived attraction is imagined and not real. Oh, you're imagining that. We get on well. We just work colleagues. We need to spend time together to do this piece of work. But it's important to safeguard our marriage relationships, and there must not even be a hint of sexual immorality. We need to make sure that appearances are appropriate, that even if there is nothing going on, a relationship is totally innocent. No one else can draw any other conclusions apart from that. And second thing, our conversations should be clean. Sometimes actions that result in inappropriate relationships start with a conversation that's suggestive or have double meanings, which may lead to a thought process that ends up in that relationship. We need all to ensure that our conversation is appropriate, and that includes now obviously any social media that we are involved with. Is every entry, tweet, or comment helpful? Certainly trolling, where a message is deliberately hurtful or insulting, that should never be part of our activity or anything like that. But the old adage that you've probably heard about any verbal comment, is it helpful, is it kind, is it necessary? That still holds good in these days of social media. If what we intend to write does not meet probably at least two of those criteria, helpful, kind or necessary, it's probably not worth saying and shouldn't be said. Paul says that any person who habitually says these things is not a child of God and should be avoided. If someone is always saying something that's hurtful, unkind, insulting, delights in causing a stir, they're probably not a child of God and should be avoided. Paul goes to the heart of the matter and says that anybody who does this shows they're still serving their own self-interest and are worshipping their own idols and are idolater and not part of God's kingdom. God is a holy God and shows his love in the work of Jesus, but also needs to punish sin and show his wrath. And therefore, it does not make sense for us Christians to be partners with those who go against God's plan and God's will. We're going to pause now and listen to that great hymn, Amazing Grace. Remember, this was written by John Newton, who was a slave trader. And when God starts his work in our lives, it's not an immediate process that we're able to become transformed human beings overnight. He was still slave trading for some years afterwards before he realized that that was wrong and became a minister. But this great song reminds us of the grace that God has shown us. I first believed.
grace will lead me home. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun.
Thank you very much. Paul then goes on to say, in contrast to the people he's just mentioned, who do not know God, living in darkness, the children, the Ephesians, are now children of light. Not of the light, but they are children of light. Elsewhere in the New Testament, it talks about of the light, but here he says they are light itself. As Jesus said, you are the light of the world. If this is the case, and they have moved, and we have moved from darkness into light, certain things will have happened. First thing is, that light produces good fruit. Goodness, righteousness, and truth. Verse 9. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. Though now that we're in the light, there'll be growth that could not happen when we're in darkness. These aspects that we can see, goodness, righteousness, and truth, are very similar to the fruit of the Spirit that we see in Galatians' letter. And notice here how they counteract the bitterness, rage and anger, brawling and slander we had at the end of chapter 4. As in the natural world, growth happens when exposed to the light. Each of these facets of being Christ-like begin to grow as we demonstrate the life of Christ. The more we spend in his presence, the more we understand the mind of God, the more we will be able to demonstrate goodness, righteousness, and truth. And the second thing is that the light enables us to distinguish between that which is pleasing and that which is not pleasing to God. Verse 10 says, we find out what pleases the Lord. We learn to choose what is right for us. We actively assess and choose what is God's way. It's not always obvious. It needs our thought, it needs our attention. It needs wisdom and discernment. The Greek word here is one that's used for testing metals. So for us, we develop skills by examination or proving what God wants. It's not always obvious the way that we should go, but as children of God, we'll understand more the mind of God to find out what pleases him. And thirdly, the light exposes that which is evil. If we expose what is right, we also show what is worthless and expose what remains. That's the nature of light. You may be searching for something, something that's lost, under the floorboard, behind a sofa, down the sofa. And you find it, but your searchlight, your torch, reveals something else, a rotten floorboard, something else you didn't want to see. And that's the nature of light. You've found something that you want, but it also reveals something that is bad. By choosing what is right, we may expose what is rotten. I was reminded of a guy I'd heard of who started new work. And his work involved travelling around a lot, lots of travelling expenses. And he was part of a team that did that, lots of travelling around. And he was a Christian, and so only submitted those travelling expenses that were actually incurred. But he soon found out that his other colleagues had got together and all submitted inflated accounts. And they'd been doing that for some time. And by submitting his lower account of what was truly carried out, he showed up their wrongdoing. He didn't intend to do that, but that became part of his activity as a Christian. Those rigged expenses were now fully exposed because he just claimed what was in order and proper. So that was hard, costly, and unintended, but comes from walking with God and walking in the light. And everything that is illuminated becomes a light, Paul says. This strange sentence seems to mean that the effect of being light is to convert darkness into light. Perhaps it's like the luminous hands on a clock. They may be in darkness, but when light is shown on them, they create their own light, so that there is generally increased light. The light that's being shined on it, and the light of the hands of the clock. And that leads Paul to quote what appears to be the fragment of an early hymn. Wake up, sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. By being light, people are attracted to light. As Jesus said, you shine so that people can see you. And people will become changed by our presence. And they too will become light. And so Paul, using these images of sleep, death, and light, to know the new life that Christ can bring us. But there's also a reminder here, as we go back to the end of chapter 4, that God is constantly needing to forgive us. Because someone has once said, the only thing that God can really count us on to do is to fail. And God knows that. It doesn't come as a surprise to him when we fail. It may come as a surprise to us, and we're disappointed in ourselves and perhaps each other. But it doesn't come as a surprise to God. But forgiveness is always there when we repent and recognize that we have done wrong and failed and turn back to God. There's always a way back. I'm always so encouraged by the prodigal son. He went back and his father welcomed him with open arms. And unfortunately, over the years, churches have not been as forgiving as God has been. And perhaps sometimes people find it hard to go back to a church. They know they've failed, they're seeking God's forgiveness, and they want to be reunited with their brothers and sisters. And I don't believe this church is like that, hard and unforgiving. We do our best to show that forgiveness that God has shown. And if you feel, in whatever your situation, that you have failed, that you want to know God's forgiveness and have received God's forgiveness. I hope that you'll feel able to come back and join us fully as children of the light. When we walk in the way of love, we become children of light, shining to those around us, transforming others. Let us then wake up and let Christ shine on us this week. Wake up, sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. We're going to finish now with a great prayer, very old prayer in the form of a hymn, Be Thou My Vision, a prayer to God that he will lead us and guide us and keep us close to him as we go through this life together. Be Thou My Vision.